I have a very special guest with me now. Joining me is William Hinton, who has written extensively on the Chinese Revolution and on life, culture, and politics in post-revolutionary China. His book, Fanshen, a documentary of revolution in a Chinese village, is a very popular and a very well-respected book, considered by most to really be a classic book. His other books include Hundred Day War, the Cultural Revolution at Tsung Ho University, and Iron Oxen, a documentary on Chinese farming, and Turning Point in China, an essay on the Cultural Revolution. William Hinton lives on a farm in Pennsylvania and continues to make frequent trips to China. He's currently working on a sequel to Fanshen that will be called Wei Gun. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, nice to be here.
I'd like to ask you how you first got interested in China and how you first embarked on your very extensive writings.
Well, that would be quite a long story, going way back to my childhood in Boston. There were people that we went to school with whose families had been in the clipper trade and so on. They always had Chinese things around. In the Boston Museum, the Art Museum, there was a great Chinese collection. And we were exposed to all that as children. I remember when I was sick with the measles, I and my sister with me for a whole week in the dark. They kept us in the dark when we had measles in those days. I told her a long story about a trip to China. I made it up, you know. But later, when I was 17, I bummed my way around the world, and I did get to Japan and China as quite a young person, and I was just fascinated by it. I had no idea that there was a revolution going on in China, but I was there when the Japanese invaded. I was in Tokyo when the war began, and I traveled through China on troop trains, full of Japanese troops. So I came home very much upset by the whole situation in Asia. And later I read Edgar Snow's book, Red Star Over China, and realized that there were forces in China who were trying to change the situation, who couldn't be bought, who couldn't be suppressed, who couldn't be crushed. And I decided I have to go see that for myself. It was a real challenge to my whole view of how the world was going.
When you live in China, and you lived there this past summer, not the one that just happened, but the summer before that, and three summers ago, how do you live? Where do you live?
Well, over the years, I've lived in China about 9 full years altogether. Now, there was that short trip in 37. a year or so at the end of the war in 45, a return with UNRWA in 47, then 7 years of work in China, living really just as a Chinese technician would live. A long period of no trips, but going back in 71, 75, 77, and 78, I then went as a guest. And a guest at a fairly high level, because Premier Zhou himself, Zhou Enlai, he liked the book Fanshan and invited me to come. Coming in at that level, of course, it's very different from going as a technician in the past. And a little bit burdensome to me, because, we got the best of treatment. Guests of the central government, when you go down into provinces, you tend to gather a retinue of people who find it expedient to go with you. There's a lot of fancy food, banquets, and toasts, you know. And it's very hard to just get down to everyday life. Not that, if you stay long enough, some of that falls away, and you can live a fairly normal life, but I think I would never again be able to live in China as the Chinese live, because, too prominent a guest anyway.
I think maybe when you started... when you really started spending a lot of time in China, it might have been easier to discern the difference between the good guys and the bad guys in the political situation when the revolution was young. Things have perhaps gotten a little more ambiguous politically in China. I'd like to get into your view of the politics of China in more depth a little later in our discussion, but I would like to ask you now what your general feelings are about the politics in China presently.
Well, I think in one sentence, I'd say the revolution isn't over. The way you had presented it here, it's like pre- and post-revolutionary China. I would say pre- and post-liberation China, but the revolution is still going on. Some of the recent events with the fall of the Gang of Four, the death of Mao, and new leadership coming to the fore, there's, of course, many young people who think, maybe they're not all so young, who think that the revolution in China is over, that there's some sort of reaction taking place. To me, these events represent swings to the right, to the left. Generally quite extreme, actually, the swings. But in they're swings in a process, a revolutionary process that's still going on. I think there's still a great deal of revolutionary energy in China and a great deal of thrust for change. It is not spent. So I'm optimistic that China will, in fact, create a viable new society, which could generally be called socialist. The difference, I suppose, in my view today, and that maybe earlier, is that it is quite clearly more difficult to do that than one might have thought. It things that one thought were resolved, for instance, the status of women, were not really resolved that easily 10 years ago, 20 years ago. Things like modernization, the use of machinery and so on, which seemed easy maybe 20 years ago, they don't seem so easy today. And all of these political questions, who will, for whom policies will be chosen and who will administer them and what the role of the people is and all these things, are not easily defined. At times it seemed that it was pretty clear, but it can't progress that easily. In other words, I'm optimistic about it. I don't think the process is over, and I think it's more difficult than we thought.
We'll get back to your views of the political situation with China in a little later on into the discussion. There are generations of people now living in China who grew up before the revolution started and who grew up in all the different stages of this continuing revolution. Do you notice when you're in China strong differences politically amongst these different generations, since they have been witness to different cultural and political situations in their own lives?
Well, there certainly are differences, but it's very hard to generalize about it because you have such diverse social situations in China. In the countryside, you have a continuum of peasant life. And it's true that the young peasants never knew the landlord oppression and didn't know the Civil War. But in terms of the way they farm, technically and so on, they farm the way their ancestors did. And their desire for change is also very great. In the countryside, you have a certain political outlook that's quite different maybe from the city. Some of the young people in the city who had high expectations in the 50s and 60s and finding the road much more difficult and so on. Some of them have become fairly cynical or have decided that no one in China really does know how to solve these problems, and a certain section of them look very much maybe idealize the West, idealize America at this point and so on. You have a great variety of opinion. Of course, the old generation tends to accept the troubles more calmly because they know how awful it was before. To them, whatever troubles come now, they're not as bad as what occurred before.
Maybe a comparison can be made. This might not be a very good comparison between the generation of people who grew up in the United States with parents who lived through the Depression. And the parents frequently seemed to carry around those memories very strongly because they were such really painful memories, living through the Depression and getting by on next to no money at all. But for their children who were growing up in much more economically prosperous times, it sometimes seemed, oh, gee, unnecessary that their parents should be carrying around the yoke of this Depression that happened so long ago, because it seemed so long ago to the children who never experienced it. And all the planning and worrying about the future and the saving of money that the parents did to some of the children, I think, seem a little unnecessary. Do you see a comparable thing happening in certain Chinese families where that fear, you don't know how terrible it was before the revolution. Do the children get exasperated with that?
I think there's something of that type of thing. The old people will, you know, can almost always justify something on the grounds that in the old society, you know, it was just... it was just a terrible scene, and regardless of what happens, no one wants that back. Well, now the young people don't want that back either. Well, they didn't experience it themselves, and many of them would be more daring or more willing to try something new or different from that which is currently being done, because that the image of that old society doesn't, you know, isn't so real to them. I think that's true. But there is the one thing there's political consensus about, I think, generally in China, is that the revolution is a good thing. And that we don't want to go, we don't want to give anyone an opening to reverse the clock and go back. You can see that in the Cultural Revolution when there were very serious false charges made against people. But generally, the thrust of the false charges was always that this or that person wants to restore the old. And on that basis, if you could convince people of it, you could unite almost everyone against that person. It was a very bad phenomenon when it was false charges. But it showed the kind of consensus that existed. It was good politics for anyone, if they could convince others that the person they opposed was really a reactionary in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you do have that consensus, but within the generations, of course, it has a different cloud.
From the reading that I've done, I've gotten the sense that before the revolution there was a very strong system of superstitions and of ghosts who could be held responsible for diseases or for mishaps or for tragedies or for unexplainable things. And I believe that perhaps one of the things that happened as the revolution happened was that that was replaced in part with a more rational, logical system of understanding. Is that true to any extent? And I'm wondering where that is now, if there's...
Well, of course, China did have a widespread set of superstitions, of course, varying from place to place. Some of the common ones, you know, had to do with, like, the eclipse is actually a wolf in the sky eating the moon, things like that. And people, even in my time in the 40s, when the eclipse occurred, people went out and made a lot of noise to scare the wolf away. You know, the press put on a big campaign, diagrams and explanations as to what an eclipse really is, and I think those who feared it were in the main convinced that this is a natural phenomena of the solar system. You know, the big thrust since 49 has been to substitute science for superstition and science for myth. On the whole, it's been successful. You'll still find people, though, who will not start a journey on an inauspicious day. In other words, there's a lot of background astrology around. The stars are out of joint. Why you would not undertake big events? You'll find, you know, a certain proportion of people like that. I have no idea statistically,
mm-hmm.
but you will find people like that. because I met it myself. But the big thing is that is not so easily overcome is the tendency to think in fixed categories, which are typical of feudalism, of earlier historical epics. The tendency, there's a strong tendency in China, if something's good, it always was good. If it's bad, it always was bad. That quantities do not change their quality, that things do not change their quality. It's a kind of categorical thinking, formalism. And you see it, I mean, it bursts out politically in all of these struggles. Well, anyone that is temporarily denounced for being in opposition, then some record was created that he or she had always been a bad apple and so on. Someone who temporarily was favored and apparently doing well, then a whole record is more or less created of marvelous history. It's a very feudal to have this type of thing. But it's damaging politically.
I'd like to get back to some of the customs and superstitions that have been replaced in many instances by science. Is there a folklore movement going on now, not to convince people to go back to this folklore and to go back to these beliefs, but just to log them, just to make sure that those traditions are not necessarily practiced, but understood and remembered as a sense of oral history, as a sense of the tradition that the people of China have come from?
What's being recorded and preserved is, of course, the folk songs, the folk art, the handcrafts, the myths and legends even. Those are being preserved and recorded. But I don't think, I haven't been aware of any sort of concerted effort to, in fact, even log the what's considered to be, you know, superstitions and so on. Of course, they're reflected in the literature of China, in the old literature of China, and in that sense, they're recorded anyway. But I think there's still, the main thrust is still to bring a scientific explanation forward and enlighten people's minds so they would not be afraid of ghosts and monsters and fate and Ouija boards and things like that. You know, there's one of the strongest old traditions was that where you're buried influences the fortunes of your progeny, you know, so that if you're, it's called geomancy, if you're buried in a propitious spot, then your offspring will be prosperous, and if you're buried in a bad spot, your offspring will suffer, you know. And, you know, things like that, there's still plenty of people in China who believe that, so that there's a strong effort to try and break that. It was built in for the gentry, see, because they could, owning land and having money, they could decide where the coffin would be buried, and the poor could be thrown in any old ditch. So then you could say, you know, when someone's poor and isn't earning anything, you could always say, well, your grandfather was buried, you know, in a terrible place, so how can you expect to be prosperous, you know? It was very well formed to justify the status quo, like many religious dogmas are. They're strong enough and damaging enough in the old society to still need refutation, I think. And again, who knows how many people in China still believe that, but similar things, maybe less direct, are still believed.
It's ironic, I think, that as people in China are trying to replace ghosts and monsters and superstitions with science and logic, people in the West, many people in the West, not all of them, are doing their damnedest to replace science, or at least to complement science with a certain amount of intuition and what is referred to as Eastern thinking, a more mystical, intuitive, spiritual, abstract. Approach to things. I'd like to go through a few of the things that the West has found so interesting and exciting and romantic lately and ask you how people in the East are dealing with it. The I Ching. Now, there's so many people in the United States who cast the I Ching, which is an ancient Chinese text that is a text of prophecy. You cast yarrow stalks, or you can toss coins, and you do that a few times, and you're left with a hexagram that that tells you something that's related to your fate, your state of being, your moment in the present, or you can glean from it what you can expect in the future. And many people in the West will consult the I Ching. How is it regarded in China?
Oh, I think in the same way as the geomancy. That is to say, is a lot of nonsense. Most people, I never met anyone that I knew believed in it. The same with Buddhism generally, Confucianism. The leftovers from the past were not these sort of open, formal old traditions, but much more, you know, just these ways of thinking that I described earlier. But I think there are, of course, there must be people in China who believe in this. One could assume that. But it's not something that young people take up as a fashion and so on. They're much more interested in perhaps hearing some Western jazz or something than they would be to have someone explain the I Ching to them. Yeah. It has no prestige. Yeah.
Does this make you laugh? Going from one country to the other and finding
I wonder about the young people here who are so lacking in knowledge of feudalism that they think they can liberate themselves with feudal superstitions. You know, to me that seems very strange, because it seems that they do not have a very strong sense of history.
But here, I think, by the people who use it, it's not seen as a feudal text, but of ancient wisdom.
Yeah, but after all, each culture reflects the society from which it sprang. And these things sprang out of feudal China or feudal India or whatever, and they're as irrelevant to, you know, current problems of the modern world as the Catholicism of Italy before the Reformation. You know, in other words, I think it's more the strangeness of these things, the romantic idea. Of course, they're based on certain human experience, certain human values. Just like the Bible, there are plenty of people who believe in the Bible that it would have all the answers for all of modern time. But to me, this seems somewhat pathetic to think that people, say, 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, had social and human experiences that can, in fact, cope widely with the problems we face today. Some of them, of course, they can, but in general, to think that you're going to solve the problems of mankind by going back 3,000 or 4,000 years, to me, is a pathetic idea.
What about Tai Chi? That's a system of movements that somewhere is, I guess, between dance and exercise. It's a system of movements that's done very slowly, that has been taken up by a lot of Americans as a discipline and as a form of exercise and as a form of self-centering. Is that practiced by many people in China now?
Quite a lot, yes. Tai Chi is a form of, you've put it quite correctly, sort of a dance exercise. It depends a lot on the inner tension between muscle and tendon and so on, rather than on violent movement or lifting weights or whatever, and sustained movements that do temper your body. I think it's something of great value. It's related to many other things of great value in Chinese tradition, like the herbal medicines, acupuncture, moxibustion. They all have some value, just as some of the propositions in the I Ching or whatever have some value. But the Chinese are finding, that one can't simply have herbal medicines. One can't simply have acupuncture. You have to expand that with all that's valuable in the Western tradition as well. They don't throw out that old tradition, or they try to sift through and find what's really useful in it.
To what extent is acupuncture used now in China?
Well, quite widely. I'm one of the few visitors that never had it. Sick as I was in China, I didn't like the idea of being stuck with with needles. And I never found that the Chinese medicines, the herb medicines, helped me very much. Some people swear that they were very effective. I've had so many of them that never helped me much at all. I've been in many crises of health in China, and usually it was something like penicillin or tetracycline or something that pulled me through. So I can't vouch for the value of these Chinese medicines, but I do believe that many of them are, of course, very valuable. Many of our medicines, after all, were originally based on herbal extracts and so on. So the acupuncture, the new development, of course, is this anesthesia, acupunctural anesthesia, whereby inserting a needle in a strategic place, you could render the whole area painless. It might be a different area. Put a needle in the arm and make your brain painless, whatever. But this apparently is, you know, a very useful thing and has advantages that our forms of anesthesia don't have. But again, it's not universal. You can't use it in every case and for everything.
You know? Do you see herbal remedies being used more by people in whose families traditions of herbal medicines have been passed on, or do you see a lot of it in the doctors too?
Well,
are herbal remedies included in the training that a doctor would go
the
through?
The Chinese they're widely developing Western medicine and promoting the old traditional medicine and trying to train people who have a knowledge of both. The old traditional doctors are being encouraged to study some Western medicine and elevate their technique. The Western-trained doctors are being encouraged to sift through the herbal tradition and acupuncture and find what's valuable there. So, you know, you'll find in any dispensary in China, you'll find drawers and drawers of herbs of various kinds, plus whatever modern medicines they can afford to have or have made or have imported. And this is true right down to the village level. The thing about the herb medicines is that people can gather them right where they live. They're very cheap. Many of them are very effective, though I can't vouch for it myself, you know. And it gives another dimension to the whole medical scene.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Hinton, who has written extensively about China, about the revolution, and about the post-revolutionary China, or as he has pointed out before, the continuing revolution. Perhaps his most well-known book is Fanshan, a book to which he is now writing a sequel. Let's talk a little bit about how people in China feel about the West. What is currently really romantic to Chinese about lifestyle or culture in the West?
Well, I think it relates in a great sense. It relates to relations with the United States, because for so long, our two countries were completely cut off from each other, not because of China's wish, but because of American government policy. China had been willing to have relations with the U.S. from the very beginning, from 49 at the time of liberation. But American policy was to cut China off, to embargo China in hopes of causing a political collapse. And so for many, many years, there were no relations. And now that the world situation has, in my opinion, the world situation has brought America to a new policy, the doors are opening and relations are expanding very rapidly. You know, just this week, there's three Chinese delegations right here in the East this week. I think in the future we're going to see more at the same time. Then people are looking to America with great hope and interest, particularly some of the young people who feel that progress in China is too slow tend to think that, oh, if only we could adopt more American ways and more American things, we'd be in better shape. So there is a sort of a romanticism about America and American life, and a slurring over of some of the deep contradictions and troubles that we have here. Just as among our young people, there has been a certain romanticism about the Chinese socialism and Chinese life, and a slurring over of the really serious contradictions and problems which they have.
A week or two ago, I read in one of the newspapers that there's a lot of young people in China who really like disco and rock and roll a lot and try to play it or to listen to it, but it's very difficult to do and that it's a much scorned hobby in China. And that's just the kind of article you read a lot. Have you found that to be very true?
Well, I've not really had personal experience with people in China who are into disco. However, there was this very strange situation where somewhere in the early 50s, dancing, social dancing, was banned. Now, it had a tradition in the revolution in Yan'an. Anna Louise Strong used to dance with Chairman Mao on Saturday night in Yan'an, foxtrots and waltzes, you know. And when I was in the liberated areas prior to 52 or 3, well, I think right up through 53 when I left China, social dances were very welcome everywhere. Our tractor school, every Saturday night, we used to have dances. They weren't disco, but, you know, they were foxtrots, waltzes, sort of old-fashioned dances. Everyone danced with whoever they liked. Men danced with men, women danced with women. Everyone had a good time. Little children danced with old folk and so on. And suddenly, somewhere in the 50s, this was considered to be decadent. And it was dropped, just suddenly, just all over the country, it was dropped. And after that, there were very little outlet for social outlet, and very little chance of, say, young people meeting and dancing together and so on. And for a long time, it got more and more severe. Jiang Qing, Mao's wife, as the leading figure in culture, gradually forced culture into a straitjacket to the point where even to write about love was considered bourgeois, and any kind of strong emotion between men and women was considered somehow decadent and so on. So now, with the overthrow of the Four and the new things coming forward in every sphere, this whole question of social life has relaxed a great deal. And with the relations with America, you've had both popular music and, you know, classical orchestras, Boston and Philadelphia orchestras going, and a shift in emphasis. So then there's this small group of people who just go nuts about the disco side, and this shocks the sensibilities of a large number of people in China, because whereas they would perhaps be one to some, this social dancing of the past, the disco scene is a bit much. I think that China should be bolder in opening up these things. After all, people who would be corrupted by it are not very dependable anyway. And most people, they might go through a phase of thinking this is tremendous, but I doubt if many people in China are going to spend a great part of their lives, discoing or worshiping American rock music or whatever. Certain of them, of course, will. But China has a difficulty coping with foreign culture and foreign visitors and foreign things in general. China is a huge, ancient country with an enormous, homogeneous population, in spite of the fact that there are 50 national minorities. They all live essentially on the borders of China. You have 900 million homogeneous people with a culture thousands of years old, and to cope with the outside world is always difficult for China. They haven't yet learned to really to do it, in my opinion.
What about the Chinese relationship to their own ancient past, to the art, for instance, which people go to museums all around the world, in their own countries and in other countries, to see the ceramics and pottery, the tradition of painting? Are there many museums in China in which this work can be seen, and with what attitude is it treated?
Before I answer that, I just had one more point on the previous question. That is, when I find going to China, that as soon as you enter China, your interest in the outside world tends to fall away. China is such a big universe in itself, and so much going on, and so different and new, that you don't miss the New York Times or the radio program or the TV that you might have watched. And so I find that very strongly, and I think it reflects something that's pretty universal in China, that they live in a world that's almost sufficient unto itself, and mm-hmm. the rest of the world doesn't seem that, pertinent when you're there.
Do you think that the people who live in China feel that as strongly as you do, you who are just a visitor and are trying to absorb every detail?
I think in the main that's central to their thinking. China's always been the Middle Kingdom, the center of the world, the center of culture. What goes on outside doesn't seem that important. Therefore, it's not easy to relate to it, and when that relationship comes anyway, it upsets people a lot. They don't know how to cope with it. That's a big subject, but we can go on to what
let's
you said
pursue,
about the ancient.
Let's just pursue that a little more, because I'm interested to hear what you think. It sounds, I can't tell whether the people who can't cope with it are mostly the people in authority positions, the people within government, or if it's the people in the villages and the cities who can't cope with it, when on the other hand, people there seem to be seeking it out, and to some extent having it withheld.
Yeah, well, there are all those trends. I think the people who primarily can't cope with it are people who are responsible for the government of China. They find it very difficult. Then you have, you have very deep problems of race in China. You don't see it until, say, suddenly a marriage is proposed with a foreigner. A marriage with a foreigner. Then, in four or five instances recently, where romance has led to marriage, the thing could not be resolved locally. It couldn't be resolved on the provincial level. It couldn't be resolved on a regional level. It had to go to the premier of China before anyone dared to say, yes, let this French girl marry this Chinese man, or this, in another case, there was an Australian girl marrying a Chinese soldier. Friendship, fine. Tourists back and forth, fine. Import some technology, fine. But suddenly, someone falls in love with someone from outside. Creates a crisis. They don't know how to cope with it. The problem is it may affect the whole family in their careers for generations to come. This is the family that married outside, Are they reliable? Are they really Chinese? It creates a problem for China.
Well, here,
other cultures have coped with it
to varying degrees, but here, if that happened, if a black and a white person wanted to marry, or if a Jewish and a Christian person wanted to marry, and if their families objected to it, it would be called bigotry or racial hatred. It would be small-minded. It wouldn't be a great tradition that we respected. We'd be angry. We'd be bitter.
Well, in China, it was people like Zhou Enlai who had the large-mindedness to say, "Look, this is treating other people with equality means that when your son falls in love with a foreign girl, it's all right for them to marry." But there's a strong feeling in China of foreign entanglement when that happens. And of course the way the West treated China made that more complicated, because for a long time, anything coming from outside was oppressive, smashing China, disregarding Chinese tradition, pushing Chinese people around. So you had a feeling that in foreign entanglement was in essence an oppressive entanglement. But then deeper below that, there's still this tremendously cohesive culture and civilization that feels in a way, well, we don't need the outside world, and this entanglement will only complicate our lives. What do we need that for? It's not a progressive thing. Mm-hmm. It's a backward thing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Hinton, who has written extensively about China. His best-known book is called Fan Shen, and we're talking, obviously, about China and his perceptions of cultural and political life there. Let's get back to relating to the ancient past and to the art of the ancient and more recent past.
Well, I think there's a great respect for the old art and culture in China. With opera and so on, there was this great struggle about old opera, new content and so on, whether it was feudal or not. But and now they're back to accepting the old opera as something very valuable. They never went through that in relation, I think, to art, sculpture, handcrafts and so on. And because the country has been in tremendous construction since 49, an awful lot of the past has been excavated. You know, when you build a highway, you build a bridge or a new building, whatever, wherever you dig in China, you dig up some of the past. And there's a great sensitivity to it. People report it at once. People come down from Peking to preserve it. And I think there's a great respect for ancient things and the creation now of museums all over the country where these things are preserved. There is a feeling of indignation about everything that the Kuomintang departed with. When they left, they took much of the best stuff that was already assembled in Peking and Nanking and so on. They took it to Taiwan. Earlier, of course, Americans either bought or, in essence, stole things. Europeans did too, and the Chinese feel upset about that. Some of their greatest art, or the great art that's well known, is in Western museums and so on. They feel badly about that. But in the last 30 years, they've unearthed an enormous amount of ancient culture that, in effect, makes what's disappeared to other countries seem small in comparison.
What's your assessment of the art that's being made now? The impression that I always get just reading the papers when I do is that all art is expected to somehow be in service of the revolution, or art that is representational enough to be visually or audially supportive of the ideas or the visions of the revolution.
Well, I think this respect for the old art is, in a way, inhibits the development of art. Because you can recreate some style or vision that's sort of in that continuum, and it's not controversial. But as soon as you start to, say, paint in a modern way or write in a modern way or some different way, then the question of what is its true political meaning comes up. And there is a great hesitancy about it. So I think the art in general, creative writing, even drama, is still in a state of crisis, in my opinion, in China. Mm-hmm. There's consensus about the Japanese War, the Liberation War, the old society is bad, but there's really no consensus about the Socialist Revolution, what's been good and bad in it, what the real essence of what should be done should be, so that people, art then becomes very controversial, very controversial. So what you see, I think, when you go around is a very skillful recreation of old forms and so on, and very little that could be called new.
Do you see that opening up in the future?
Yeah, I think it will open up. I'm disappointed that it didn't open up more already. You had some of this peasant art that was quite strikingly new, because in the past peasants were too poor to create very much, and then that was seized on by the four and used as a club against professional artists, and so that became very controversial, and I'm not sure now as to how this is developing. But I feel that the whole cultural scene needs to to have much more of the hundred flowers spirit. There have been times when they let the flowers bloom. People should create what they feel like creating, but then they've retreated from that. There's a tendency, both it's both a Chinese tendency and perhaps a socialist tendency, to have some sort of control over creative expression that's complete, you know. I think it's an old Chinese tendency as well. From the emperor comes, you know, certain what's right and what's wrong, and everyone's expected to follow it. Socialism, being a centrally planned society, has a strong tendency that way too. I think it's a problem that hasn't been resolved.
Well, let's talk about the women's movement within China. You had alluded before to the thought that the women's movement was not going as smoothly as it had looked like it was going to go. China is, after all, a country where women's feet were bound not all that long ago. So there was a lot of drastic rethinking and altering of attitudes that would have had to be done before anything resembling equality could have been achieved amongst men and women in China. What progress do you think has been made towards equality in China?
Well, I think a lot of progress has been made, and it's come, of course, with the first, the breaking up of the feudal system, with every family getting land. In the north, women never even worked on the land traditionally, and with the land reform, they began to be producers in the field as well as in the home, and this gave them a status that enabled them, for instance, to demand and get a divorce or to demand and get a split in the property. In other words, and then in industry, even more so. Industry was opened up to women, so the same jobs that men had could be had by women, and this gave them a status in society and a status in the family as earners of wages and so on. That quite transformed the old feudal family and the lowly status of women. But all these things are relative, and a lot of those holdovers still exist in people's minds. Women, in fact, have to fight for these better industrial jobs. In almost every field, anyone handing out such a job, making a decision, would naturally give it to the man rather than the woman, usually. And the same in the village, the better the technical jobs, like, say, being the village electrician, 99% of the time it would be a man who would be sent for that training. You can see, I think, the status of women's rights by the fact that most of the people in the field wielding hoes are women, 70%, 65%, 80% even sometimes. There are many other jobs in the village, like hauling freight on the road, doing contract work for a factory somewhere. It isn't that women are never part of it, but you can see that men tend to get these jobs by the fact of who's left in the field, which is the lowest, really, status. It's more women than men. So there's a long way to go. Then free marriage is in the law, but free marriage has to be fought for with every generation, apparently. It isn't just something that
Tell us what you
place.
Mean by free marriage.
Well, what I mean by free marriage is free choice of mate by young people. In Longbow Village, people insist that, you know, any young married person, if you ask them, they'll insist that they chose their partner of their own free will. But there are, you know, strange cases of, for instance, a wife who, because her brother had a wife from outside, whose brother could not find a wife. So this is just last year, her father came and told her to divorce her husband in Longbow and come home. And he married her off and got a bridal price for that, with which he then arranged a marriage for his son. You know, the Chinese press today is full of those kind of things. In other words, people are supposed to have free choice in marriage, and as compared to 10 years ago or 20 years ago, there's great progress in that, but there's still lots of people who are frustrated in that. There are lots of people who cannot. Well, one thing is, without dancing, without, you know, there are no social forums where young people can meet. If your parents don't introduce you to someone, how do you meet someone? The people in your own village are all related. You can't marry them. They're all of maybe of the same surname. It's considered wrong to marry in your own surname, which is a good thing. Well, how do you meet someone from outside? If you go to high school, fine. If you go to, for some factory training program, you may well meet some. But many people live their whole life right in their village. Someone has to introduce them to somebody, you know. Well, you can see how some of these old customs and so on tend to be perpetuated, and mother-in-law problems. It's considered normal for the girl to go live in her husband's home. It's considered very demeaning for a man to go live in his wife's home. There's a big campaign last year to convince people that it's no worse for, you know, the one is no worse than the other. Because in the old society, see, if a man went to live in the girl's home, he lost his surname and his children became the descendants of the girl's family.
What form would a campaign like that take?
Well, usually some case that occurred in real life that then was resolved in favor of a modern outlook and then became widely publicized, you know, or a series of cases. So the press would go out of its way to publicize such things. And then there'd be discussion in study groups and in schools and so on about, you know, how backward this is to think that a man who moves to his wife's village is a eunuch, you know, and a girl who moves to her husband's village is, it's somehow normal, you know. So it would arise out of some abuse of a modern way and then wide publicity for a modern solution.
William Hinton, before we have to conclude our discussion this afternoon, I'd like to go back to some of the general political overviews that you have of China. Now, recently there was the Chinese invasion of Vietnam, which was terrible press. Really, I think it disappointed so many people in America. How did you read that situation? How did that strike you?
Well, I saw it in the context of a whole new world situation where, in fact, not only for China, but for the rest of the world, the Russian expansion has become the main problem. And Vietnam, of course, has some expansionist tendencies, which if it was just between Vietnam and China and Vietnam's neighbors, would not be a major problem in the world. But Vietnam had support in this from the Soviet Union and, in fact, invaded Cambodia with arms and supplies and support from the Soviet Union, without which they could not have done this. So from the point of view of China, it is a form of encirclement where Russian power linking up with Vietnamese power threatens very seriously basic Chinese interests. And China's response was a limited blow indicating the seriousness of this whole situation. I think it was an effective blow. It's hard to judge overall. I wasn't shocked by it. Whether it accomplished the objective, that's something else. But it was undertaken as a limited blow to say to both the Soviet Union and Vietnam, you know, you can't just override China's interests in this way. And in that sense, it had an enormous impact on the whole world because up to that point, there had been armed intervention supported by the Soviet Union in the form of Cuban troops and other ways that no one had really opposed. People had wrung their hands and talked about it, but they hadn't done anything about it. Well, that isn't entirely true, of course. There was the Zaire question where, you know, the Katangan invasion from Angola where French sent troops and others sent troops, so that other moves had been made in the world. But To me, it represents a response to a new world situation, which for most people is not at all clear. Most people are not willing to grant that in today's world, the Soviet Union represents a new imperialist power, which is threatening the whole world in ways that require a worldwide response. You see, most people haven't seen that situation yet. Most people don't recognize that that's true. To me, it seems a valid thing. It's something the Chinese have been pointing out for some years already. And to me, a limited blow on the Vietnam border was a rational response to that situation.
I regret, William Hinton, that we're almost out of time. I'd like to, before the program ends, ask you a little bit about the project that you're working on now, the sequel to Fan Shen that is occupying so much of your time.
Well, it's a book. I've given it the title Wei Gong, which means for the public, which is sort of a symbol just of the collective life that's been built in the Chinese village since the land reform. Fan Shen was a word meaning to turn over, which was symbolic of the peasants rising up. Wei Gong is a word meaning together, in essence, which is symbolic of the pooling of land, the building of a cooperative agriculture, which is the heart of the big change that has occurred since. But there's a very complicated history of this in development in 30 years. I'm finding, I guess my problem is it's much too much to put into one book. And then the Cultural Revolution comes along, and the Gang of Four period and this modernization period coming on its heels, and perhaps I guess I should be writing two or three books. But I'm trying to do with that book something like what I did with Fan Shen. That is to say, in some way, sum up the whole Chinese Revolution through the life of one village. And it's not easy. I find it very difficult, particularly because the Cultural Revolution, for instance, is very hard to understand. It's extremely complicated, upheaval, explosion almost, very hard to understand.
Well, I know many people, myself including, who learned a lot about China through reading your book, Fan Shen, and I look forward to the completion of the follow-up book that you're working on now. William Hinton, we're out of time. It's really been a great pleasure to have you here. I thank you so much for making the trip to Fresh Air.
Well, I enjoyed it very much.
I'm glad. My guest has been William Hinton, who has written extensively about China. His most well-known book is called Fan Shen. He has also written a book on the Cultural Revolution and a book called The Iron Ox, also about China. His books are still available, and he's written about many aspects of life and culture and politics within China. He, by the way, lives on a farm in Pennsylvania. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon on the show at 2 o'clock, we'll be joined by Paul Farou, who has written a lot about traveling on the trains. He loves trains. At 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by the man who did a lot of the research on vaudeville and burlesque that can now be heard in the show Sugar Babies. A lot of those jokes and stuff are things that he found out through his research. He'll be with us at 3. At 4, we'll be joined by Tony Bird, a white South African musician who left South Africa because of the politics there, has been living in England, and will be performing this week and in Philadelphia at the Main Point. I think you'll like his music. He'll be performing for us live in the studio. Contributing to this afternoon's edition of Fresh Air has been Francis Davis. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. Technical direction today provided by Paul Keller. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a very good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Bob Edwards.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered. was at the butcher. He says, look what I'm got now. I says, what are they? When he told me veal cutlets and butterfly pork chops, I says, man, that's a delicacy. I don't know what you're talking about. When I buy a piece of meat, I'll watch and see when it goes on sale.
The United Auto Workers are negotiating a contract with General Motors that will set a pattern for the auto industry, and one of their major demands is a benefit they won't collect for a while. Tonight on All Things Considered, auto workers demand that pensions keep up with inflation.
Also tonight, more Kennedy-Carter discussion. Carter workers getting advice to give up campaigning in New Hampshire and tend to southern states.
The White House says a Kennedy run can help the president.
A petition circling Capitol Hill urging Mr. Carter to get out of the race right now.
There is other news. Hurricane Frederick slams into the Gulf Coast, and the Palestine Liberation Organization buys tables at a Black Caucus dinner.
Hearings on the Progressive Magazine's unpublished bomb story.
Much movie watching at the Venice Film Festival.
No gondola riding?
They didn't say.
First, this news from Diane Diamond.
Hurricane Frederick was devastating. At least 8 people were killed, hundreds were injured, when Frederick's 130-mile-an-hour wind slammed into the Gulf Coast. Damage in Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida has been estimated in the hundreds of millions, if not billions, of dollars. Nearly 500,000 people evacuated their homes before Frederick hit. Many went back today to find nothing or next to nothing. As a result, looting broke out in Mobile and its suburbs. The National Guard has been called out to patrol city streets. More on the aftermath from Steve Feldberg of member station WTSU.
The Gulf Coast city of Mobile appears to be the hardest hit. 160,000 residents are without electricity. An Alabama power company spokesman, Ed Crosby, says it may be 10 days or more before the company can overcome Frederick's impact.
We had extensive damage to our system, including broken poles, transformers down on the ground, wires are just everywhere. In addition to that, our main transmission lines into the Mobile area were damaged extensively.
Crosby says 1,000 workers from Alabama and Georgia will be involved in the effort to restore power to Mobile. Extensive power outages are also reported in portions of Mississippi and the Florida coast. President Carter will fly into Mobile Friday to survey the effects of Hurricane Frederick after declaring 30 counties major disaster areas. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Feldberg in Troy, Alabama.
Hurricane Frederick has now been downgraded to a tropical storm, but still packs winds of up to 60 miles an hour. Forecasters say the greatest remaining threat will come from heavy rain, flooding, and tornadoes as the storm moves north. A delegation of senators urged President Carter today to support a 5% increase in defense spending. That's 5% over what Mr. Carter has already proposed. After a session at the White House, one senator said President Carter doesn't agree that an extra 5% hike is necessary. Sam Nunn of Georgia told reporters the president didn't flatly turn the idea down. Instead, he requested another meeting on the subject. An Associated Press NBC News poll says that Americans now give Jimmy Carter the lowest job rating of any president in nearly 30 years. Despite Mr. Carter's efforts to change the course and image of his administration this summer, the poll says he is now in serious trouble with almost every segment of the population. That includes such politically crucial segments as Democrats and Southerners. Overall, only 19% of those interviewed rated the president's work as good or excellent. The New England Journal of Medicine reported today there is new evidence showing some cancers can be inherited. More on the story from Jim Randall in Boston.
Scientists at Beth Israel Hospital here have been studying 3 generations of an Italian-American family. Of 40 family members, half of them have a rare cancer of the kidney, which usually afflicts 1 in 1,000. That tragic fact of life for this family has allowed the researchers to pinpoint, for the first time, a genetic fault common to each victim, which is significant for us all. It means that cancer, at least this particular kind of cancer of the kidney, can be inherited. The seeds of the disease handed down from generation to generation. It also means that this chromosomal abnormality could be identified before birth, during amniocentesis, for example. And it suggests the future possibility that all the nearly 100 different kinds of cancer may someday be cataloged by their genetic markers by studying families with unusually high incidences of a particular cancer. For National Public Radio, Jim Randall in Boston.
Donald McHenry has been nominated as the next ambassador to the United Nations, and he appeared before a Senate confirmation hearing today. McHenry would succeed Andrew Young, who resigned because he held an unauthorized meeting with the Palestine Liberation Organization. Young said he thought the U.S. policy of not talking to the PLO was stupid. McHenry was asked today what would happen if he received a directive against his personal convictions. McHenry acknowledged there would be those instances.
But it doesn't seem to me that one has or can expect that every policy decision is going to come out in a way in which you like. When the point arises that that policy reaches the limit of my conscience and my forbearance, then it seems to me my obligation to leave that position.
McHenry's hearing lasted only 10 minutes, and that's seen as an assurance he will be approved by the full Senate. On Wall Street, prices were mixed at the close of trading today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was down a fraction of a point, ending the day at 870.73. Trading was moderately active. On the American Exchange, prices were mixed, and again, trading was active. That's the news. I'm Diane Diamond in Washington.
A week ago, Senator Edward Kennedy let it be known that his family no longer objects to any bid he might make for the presidency. All week, Kennedy's star seemed to be rising, even as President Carter's polls were dropping. After such a week, you would expect the White House to be filled with gloom. But it isn't. NPR's Carolyn Craven spent the day there. She says the mood is definitely up.
Relief was the word used by one senior White House official over recent indications.